We'll have an official launch on July 12th at the Shiloh Baptist Church Old Site. Books can be purchased beginning at 10 a.m. We'll begin the launch at 11, and then we'll have more signings from 12 to 1 o'clock. The person who's going to do the keynote launch is a friend and colleague, a very prominent African-American woman diplomat. Her name is Linda Thomas Greenfield, and she was most recently the United States Ambassador to the United Nations. So I'm really honored that Linda will be here in our historic city for my book launch.
To write a book like this, I'm sure, how difficult was it?
Well, I'll tell you, Ted, when I retired, my first goal, my first order of business was to write my memoir. I wanted to do it while everything was fresh in my mind.
Sure.
I didn't want to have the fog of war to creep up. But interestingly, I had been told by Secretary of State Powell, former General Colin Powell, that I was going to be extremely busy in retirement. He said, you're going to have to learn how to say no to some things. Colleague ambassadors would tell me the same thing. And I didn't learn to say no because I got involved in a lot of very important work, charitable boards, nonprofits, continuing to serve, which is what the Foreign Service is all about. So my memoir kind of just languished a bit, my desire to get it going. But I would do interviews about the work that I had been doing, and I began jotting down certain things and saying to people when they were asking me to be on boards, well, you know, I really have to do this memoir, and that is really on the front burner, but your work is important too. So after all of this, I finally buckled down and said, we're going to put these things aside, and I'm going to concentrate full time on writing this memoir and getting it polished. And that was a lot, that had a lot to do with a gentleman that I had met. He's a judge in Cincinnati, Ohio, where I went to graduate school. And he would encourage me, he would send me little notes every day. What are you doing, Ambassador? How much have you written? Every day, Judge Tyrone Yates was with me on this journey. So I have to say something about him with a great big thank you.
You talk about Walker Graham, because we talk about that, and you write, I found a learning environment that was nurturing and teachers who were first-rate and caring. They were stern and no-nonsense. Our resource and materials were never equal to those of James Monroe, Lafayette, or Maury, the white schools, but we made up for it with our teachers. Xavier Richardson has said those same things to me and others, and I just find that everyone who came through Walker Grant talks about the teachers.
Well, we need to continue to talk about those teachers because they were indeed jewels and gems individually and professionally. I think about, I'll name just a few, but I had my first French lessons at Walker Grant. The teacher was Mrs. Margaret Wiley, and she used to tell us about having studied at the Sorbonne. Oh, that sounded so exotic. Of course, later in my life, I end up spending lots of time in France and traveling there. And Mrs. Wiley would be very, very stern about our lessons, the grammar. We also had literature, French literature, and I went on to major, to have a minor in French at Virginia State, which continued that. So I always find it so fascinating that when I'm riding in a taxi in Washington or anywhere around the world, I can detect a French accent. And when I greet somebody or make a comment in French, they're always so incredulous and they want to know, firstly, where are you from? D'où-vous? And where did you learn French? And I said, in Fredericksburg, Virginia. Well, that just about bowls people over. So that was the French lesson. And then I had an amazing teacher in Mrs. Marguerite Young, who is still living in Fredericksburg today. Mrs. Young was our business teacher. She taught me and all of her classes about typing and all of that. I was the fastest typist along with my classmate Terry Edwards, and I still am able to zip through the computer now with the lessons from Mrs. Young. Mrs. Young was, again, no nonsense. You didn't show up late to her class, and you had to have all of your tools there in order. And then we had Mrs. Blonnie Tipton was our music teacher. Was she an amazing person? Our band was such a great band, the concert band, that we would compete in Virginia competitions. And our band was so good, we got Superior Plus Plus, which was just off the chart great. So I played clarinet there and went on to play clarinet at Virginia State. So my love of music and the importance of the arts, that was all nurtured right there at Walker Grant School. And then Mrs. Janie Pratt was my first grade teacher. Mrs. Mamie Scott was my third grade teacher. And she started a little store in our classroom where we would sell pencils. And we learned mathematics through practical work by selling and computing right there in the classroom. We had a little store. So, and math was always my challenging subject. Mrs. Louise Lucas was our algebra and physics teacher, and I took those tough courses. But I managed to get through. So kudos to all of those wonderful teachers. And Mr. Johnny Johnson taught me art in the sixth grade.
Yeah.
He taught art well to many people, but I never learned to draw very well. But that is not anything against him. It was just my limitation.
Boy, but that, we see this over and over. Mm-hmm. That school really produced, despite all the things that you could have looked upon as a disadvantage, they still challenged you.
Well, that is absolutely right. And that's why in any biographies of me, I have to insist that the fact that Walker Grant is mentioned as a school that I went to.
Yeah.
Walker Grant School in Fredericksburg, Virginia.
Yes. There's such pride in that.
Lots of pride.
We do need to spend a little bit of time about your time in South Africa. Because, again, I learned so much about the U.S. Foreign Service and things that I assumed about how it was. You were in great danger.
Well, at the time I was in South Africa, yes, it was a very volatile situation as the country was looking for ways to transition from apartheid to a non-racial government where all the people of South Africa could vote, which was not the case before. But you know, while there were a lot of problems in South Africa, the Foreign Service officers, my colleagues around the world, face very dangerous situations every day.
Yeah.
But in South Africa, you're correct. There are many people who did not want a transition to take place. But there was a core of individuals, including the then president, F.W. de Klerk, who wanted to work with others because I think he saw the handwriting on the wall. South Africa was considered a pariah state by most of the world. Only a few nations would recognize the Bantustans, or the separate homelands that had been established for the African populations. But he decided, no, we've got to try to find a way forward. And the U.S. Embassy, our ambassadors at the time, Ambassador William Swing and then Ambassador Princeton Lyman, worked very closely with our embassy staff members, which was a very large contingent. I was the only black person in the very large political section we had there at the time. And I kind of found that a little strange, too. But then as a black person going into a country that had apartheid, and as a black person who had been a product of segregation, I guess,
right,
I was a little, I thought about it more than one time before I agreed to put that country on my list of next assignments. But I did. And I found that to be such an enriching experience because literally, Ted, we were seeing a nation reborn. We were seeing structures change to be inclusive of all of the population entities there, and not just a few. So the fact that the U.S. could play an important role in working with other nations of goodwill was very positive, because this was just, it could have gone anyway. It could have been completely complete upheaval. It could have been all-out war, fighting. But the transition took place in a peaceful way when those elections were finally held.
You write in the book that when you went to Pretoria, your mother was not happy.
My mother was not happy. She thought, why would my daughter want to put herself in this kind of jeopardy? I'm an only child, Ted. So my mother was always very, very protective.
Yeah.
Even though I pretty much went and went my own way and did things. I listened, but I still took the risks.
Yeah.
And she said, well, I'll just leave her to the Lord to protect her, which he has through all of this work. But no, she wasn't happy about it. And I had friends who weren't happy. They wondered how I'd be treated if I got sick because of apartheid. Would I have hospital care? But interestingly, I did. I had to have surgery twice in South Africa. And one of my surgeons was an Afrikaner in Pretoria. And I thought, my goodness, here's an Afrikaner who slit my throat and I'm still alive because I had a thyroid issue. But he was a great doctor. So I had a great experience despite the negative issues that were surrounding South Africa and the challenges at the time.
And reading this brought back a lot of memory. I had forgotten about a lot of this. That, like you say, in the 80s and the early 90s, South Africa was in the news all the time.
Ted, it was in the news all the time. And as I said, nobody knew what was going to happen from day to day.
No.
We experienced killings of blacks in the townships who were on the trains, and mass murders and internecine fighting in KwaZulu between supporters of one political party, the ANC, and the Pan-Africanist Congress, and the Zulus and the Inkathas. And it was very treacherous period. And we didn't know how it was going to end, but we knew we had to keep fighting. We knew we had to keep working for constructive ways to bridge those troubled waters that people were experiencing in South Africa. And I was in the middle of all of that.
Boy, and to see it all come together.
To see it all come together and to see the people from around the world who wanted South Africa to succeed, to see the groups that came, to see the American artists, to see the American legislators, to see the American people in civil society. Mrs. Coretta Scott King came, actors such as Danny Glover, Angela Bassett, Stevie Wonder, all kinds of people came to South Africa promoting voting and wanting people to register to vote to help them understand how important their voices would be in this process.
And we all know the name Nelson Mandela. You knew the man really well.
I did. Clearly, that is a pinnacle of my diplomatic career. Three ambassadorships are a wonderful honor. But the time and the experiences that I was able to share with Mr. Mandela early on when I arrived in 1990, and that continued until 1996 when my tour in South Africa ended, were just amazing, and those are reflected in the book.
Well, and the other thing, and I told you that when I read it, you got goosebumps of seeing when you had lunch with him before you left, and not just lunch and people around you, just the two of you.
Yes, Ted. As I say in the book, when we leave post, we usually pay farewell calls on the interlocutors or the people with whom we've engaged to thank them for the opportunity to have served and the experiences that we've shared and the accomplishments we've made. So I had my assistant request a farewell call on Mr. Mandela, who was now the president of the country. So I expected that I'd probably go to his office for the farewell. And she sent a note to me on a white sheet of paper with a little blue Sharpie and a smiley that said, lunch, 12:30 with Madiba, which is his clan name. So I thought, oh my goodness, lunch. And it wasn't in his office, it was lunch at his home. And it was just the two of us for the most delightful end of tour and lunch and conversation that anyone could possibly imagine. No note taker, no ambassador, no cameras, just the two of us.
Just talking, friends.
Just talking. And
you'd been through a lot.
We'd been through a lot, and he talked about KwaZulu-Natal, which still was a challenge and still remains a challenge today, as do many parts of the country. And he asked my comments about things, and I thought, Mr. Mandela is asking what I'm thinking about these things. And I was very honored. I was honored beyond words.
He had to appreciate the fact that you were there, you wanted to be there, and you were doing what you could, and especially with who you are and your background and all of that.
Yes, I'm sure he did. He's a very, very astute individual, as were so many of the freedom fighters in that period. And I learned much from him, from his example, and that of others such as Govan Mbeki, And to see and to know what they experienced and yet remained individuals who wanted to move their nation forward in the best possible way was a real instruction for me.